1 Samuel 4 through 5, the third talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on November 19, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel 4 and 5 today. I want to begin by making a couple comments with respect to what I was saying last week. Then I'm going to look through Samuel 4 and 5, and then at the end, I'll solicit your help in sorting out an issue that comes up in those chapters. There were a couple of questions last week on a verse in chapter 2, verse 35 of chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, where it says, "But I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always." And the question was, who's who in this? Who is the faithful priest? Who is the enduring house? And who is he who will walk before my anointed? And who is my anointed? It makes most sense, given what we learn in the New Testament in particular, that the faithful priest, ultimately the faithful priest, is Jesus Christ himself. So what he would be predicting here is that he would be raising up this faithful priest, this priest who will do according to what is in my God's heart and in my God's soul. So a truly faithful priest in every respect. "And I will build him an enduring house," and my translation is, "and he will walk before my anointed always." My anointed is usually with respect to the line of kings in Israel, but most specifically, that line results in Jesus Christ the king, so that seems to be talking about Jesus Christ as well. If that's the case, then who is he who will walk before my anointed always? The he is not explicit. It's just a third person singular verb. That's true in the Greek and in the Septuagint as well as in the Masoretic text. So that could be translated it rather than he. And it seems to me that probably makes the most sense out of this passage. So what will walk before my anointed always will be the enduring house. So what he's predicting then, if that's right, is that there will come along this faithful priest. And who is that faithful priest? That's Jesus Christ himself. And that faithful priest will be thoroughly obedient to God. And that God is going to build up an enduring house. And I think that means a household, a group, a family of people. And that's ultimately the redeemed, the righteous. He will build an enduring house, and it, that house, will walk before Jesus Christ as king or as priest always. I think that makes better sense of that verse and the helpful thing to note is that he could be it instead of he. Okay, where we left off last time was this discussion of the situation in Israel at the time after the judge, towards the end of the period of the judges. And the high priests at this time are the sons of Eli, and they are corrupt and they are wicked. They are taking of the offerings that are brought in to be presented to God. They were given a portion by law. There was a certain portion that they were supposed to take for themselves for their own food. But they took more than they were allowed to take and threatened to take it by force if necessary. And in addition to that, it points out a little bit later that they have been sleeping with the women who work in the temple. So they are taking advantage of their position for their own pleasure. And so it's this pathetic situation where the highest ranking representatives of God in Israel are corrupt and are wicked. But God brings along a prophet, Samuel, who is favored by God and is the bright light in this scenario, and God speaks to him. So in this period of time, things are bad, but there is something hopeful. But God has spoken to Eli through a prophet other than Samuel, as well as spoken to Samuel directly, and predicted that Eli's family, because of their wickedness, will be punished, and that the descendants of Eli will have short lives. They will not live to a ripe old age, and that they will see the decline of the temple in which they have served. And as a sign that this will come to pass, God has predicted that his two sons will both die on the same day. That's where things left off last chapter. We'll start off in chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. Thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer, while the Philistines camped in Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. The first problem that we run into is the first verse. It is hard to know how to take this verse, whether it is better attached to that which precedes it or whether it is better attached to that which follows. And this is what the difference would be. It could be saying, in following from what was in the end of chapter 3, where it was talking about Samuel, thus Samuel grew and the Lord was with him and let none of his words fail. And all Israel from Dan even to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. It could be just going on and summarizing that and saying, thus the word of Samuel, that is, the word about Samuel, his fame, his reputation, came to all Israel. So that's one possibility, is that it's summarizing what came before. The other possibility is that it is indicating that to this prophet that God has raised up, that God has spoken and given him word, which he then gave to all Israel, which was, we need to attack the Philistines. In context, that would be what would make the most sense, is that the word would be, from Samuel, would be that we need to attack the Philistines. I'm inclined to think that it's the former. The latter would be, it seems to me, problematic. The former, that it summarizes what precedes it and is just indicating that all of Israel came to know about this, about Samuel, who he was, and his status as a prophet. It seems to me that fits much better. If it is a prediction on the part of Samuel, or a word of God that Samuel is giving to the Israelites that they should go out against the Philistines, they get beat by the Philistines. And that's a little problematic, it seems to me. So I'm taking it to go with the preceding rather than with the following. Okay, in any case, Israel and the Philistines go to battle. This happens between Aphek and Ebenezer. Both of those are just west of Shiloh. They're about 10, 12 miles west of Shiloh. They're not too far from the Mediterranean coast. And in fact, they aren't too far from Samuel's homeland in Ramah, which is just a couple miles short of that. They engage in battle, and there are 4,000 Israelites killed in that battle. That's a lot. I mean, if you think about even our war in Iraq, I don't know how many American soldiers have been killed now, but it's not even 4,000. I mean, it's much less than 4,000. So 4,000 for the nation of their size at that time, that's a significant number. So they come back from the defeat, and they're trying to figure out what happened and what they should do next. And there isn't even any discussion as to what the problem is. There's no hint of various theories as to what they should do next. They just say, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" There's no hesitation to attribute this to the activity of Yahweh himself. And that's why it has happened. So, they come up with a solution to the problem. They are going to go and get the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant is a box. It's a box, something like this. It's not huge. Covered with gold plating. Inside of it are three objects. At least at this time, I think they're just three objects. There are the tablets that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai. There is a jar of manna, a sample of what God had given to the people of Israel to provide for them in the wilderness. And there's the staff of Aaron. Those are the only three things, I think, at this time that are in the ark. Then on top of the ark, there are two cherubim. And the cherubim have outstretched wings, and I think they're standing like this or something like that. That's what the pictures usually show, facing each other. And in between is the seat of God. So on top of the ark, between the cherubim, is considered to be the seat of God. It is the most holy object in all of Israel. No one can touch it. It has to be carried on poles by the priests. So when they were coming through the desert, the priests would put poles through these rings on the side of the ark and lift it up, and they would carry it. So the solution to their problem seems to be, let's just take that ark into battle with us, and that will lead us to victory. So they send to Shiloh, where it's apparently located at the time. And it says that the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. They are the high priests. They are ultimately in charge of this ark. So there must have been some discussion with them about taking this ark. And they must have convinced them that this is a good thing to do. It seems to me that it's possible that Eli objected. Because we'll see later that Eli is particularly nervous about the fate of the ark. And my suspicion is that he may have objected. But, as we've seen before, he does not have great control over his sons. His sons act quite independently of him and probably overruled him. Next section. And it happened as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp that all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. And the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the Ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So they go and get the Ark, they bring the Ark to the camp, and when it arrives in the camp, there are shouts of jubilation. It's a great morale boost for the Israelites, and they're thinking, now we're going to beat them. This is a great thing that's happened. The shout is so great that the Philistines hear it. And apparently they're aware of what has happened, that this is the Ark that has arrived. And they're scared. They're scared because they have heard the history of Israel. If we remember back in Numbers, it was saying that the people that were living in Palestine had heard about the Israelites' trek across the desert and what had happened even before the trek, what had happened in Egypt, the plagues that had been inflicted upon the people of Egypt, and the trek across the desert and how God had led them through that with many wondrous things. So the Philistines are scared. And they're saying, nothing like this has happened. Now we are going to be the targets of this God who did so much damage to the Egyptians. But instead of being scared to death, the Philistines, they look at the situation and they say, we've got to fight. We've got to defeat the Israelites. Otherwise, we will be subject to them. We will be slaves to them, just as we have been there, just as they have been slaves to us to this point. And I suspect that it's not fun to be enslaved to a former slave of yours. And they know that. So the Philistines fight hard. They're fighting for their lives in many respects. And they defeat the Israelites once again. And this time they kill 30,000 people. So that's a huge number for these times. Included in the casualties are Hophni and Phinehas. They both died, and I would suspect they died standing by the Ark and probably defending it as the Philistines came to the Ark to capture it. And that happened just as God had predicted. Next section. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. When he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, eagerly watching, because his heart was trembling for the Ark of God. So the man came to tell it in the city, and all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the noise of this commotion mean?" Then the man came hurriedly and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And he said, "How did things go, my son?" Then the one who brought the news answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great slaughter among the people. And your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been taken. And it came about when he mentioned the ark of God that Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck was broken and he died, for he was old and heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. The battle has happened. There are a few survivors who are fleeing from the battle site. One of them is a man of Benjamin. And he runs from where the battle took place, the 12 miles or so, to Shiloh. And it says that his clothes are torn and there's dust on his head. The torn clothes and the dust on his head could just be from the battle, a result of the conflict. But it could also be in a sign of mourning, that what has happened is so catastrophic that he has torn his clothes and put dust on his head, all as a indication of the mourning that he is enduring. Eli has been waiting in Shiloh, sitting by the side of the road. Now, I'm not sure where that is in proximity to the temple. We've seen before that he was sitting on a seat just outside the temple. This could be the same seat. It could be elsewhere. But he's on the road that comes from where the battle was. Obviously, he's anxious for news. And as we'll see later, his anxiety is primarily with respect to the ark. He's really worried about the fate of the ark. This man comes into the city and he apparently announces what has happened to the people in the city, and they cry out. This is a disastrous thing that has occurred. Eli doesn't hear this first report. He hears the outcry, but he doesn't know exactly the details of the outcry. He must have suspected that it was bad from the outcry. So Eli wants to know the details. What exactly happened? And the man reports to Eli what had happened, says that he has escaped the battle, but that it was disastrous for the Israelites, and that Hophni and Phinehas, his sons, died in the battle. And more importantly, because this is the point at which Eli falls over dead, he says that the ark of God has been taken. So the news about his sons may have been sad, but it's the taking of the ark that is particularly devastating to Eli. He just falls over backwards off his seat and breaks his neck. He was 98 years old, so he's getting well along in years. We know that his eyesight was bad. And it says here that he is heavy. He apparently overweight. So Eli dies on the same day that his sons died, having heard the news. And it was 40 years that he was a priest and a judge in Israel. Next section. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was taken and that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son." But she did not answer or pay attention. And she called the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken." So having heard this horrible news, obviously she was pregnant before her husband went off to battle and was probably coming close to term, doesn't say exactly how close. It says about to give birth. She hears the news and she goes into labor. It's a psychological shock to her. She goes into labor and she delivers a child. The women that are attending to this birth, it must be clear to them that the mother is suffering greatly. And they tried to cheer her up by telling her, don't worry, you gave birth to a son. But she does not respond. It doesn't pull her out of this. She dies in the process of giving birth to this son. But before she dies, she names the child, and she names it Ichabod, which means no glory. And she says, because, saying the glory has departed from Israel. These events for her are indicative of the glory having departed from Israel. What is the glory of Israel? It's that which makes Israel great. And what is it that makes Israel great? It's their relationship with God, the Creator. So it's a recognition that God has withdrawn his favor from Israel. And that is the most sad thing. That is terrible news. She says, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken. So this is the low point in the history of Israel up to this time. Since leaving Egypt, this is the low point. Even through all of the bad news of the judges, of the period of the judges, it wasn't as bad as this. Chapter 5, first section. Now the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place again. But when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all those who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The Philistines have captured the ark. Great thing. Now the question is, what do you do with it? And they decide that they are going to put it apparently in the temple where the statue of Dagon is. It's unclear what, I suspect there's symbolism here. I mean, there's some reason why they put it there, and I suspect there's symbolism involved here, that apparently they want to show the submission of Yahweh to Dagon. So they're putting it there next to Dagon for Dagon to kind of rule over. I suspect that's why they chose to put it in that particular location. The statue of Dagon then, during the night, falls over and falls face down before the Ark of the Covenant, which is a great scene. We've got the Ark doesn't speak. Dagon is just this stone statue, and yet we've got this animated thing happening that is indicative of reality. The Ashdodites, that's a great name for a group of people. The Ashdodites come in, they see Dagon down, face down in front of the ark, and they figure, well, strong wind, something blew it over, and they set it back up. And then the next morning, once again, the statue's fallen down, but this time, both hands break off, and the head breaks off. So we just have this trunk of Dagon, and then his hands and head separated from that trunk. Two times in a row, they realize that there's something more significant here that has happened than just a bad pedestal. And then it says that the priests of Dagon, neither the priests of Dagon nor those who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. I'm not sure exactly what the significance of that is, other than it was a very momentous event, which is remembered long after the event took place. But exactly why they don't step on the threshold, other than the fact that the threshold is the thing that, that broke the head off, apparently, other than that, I'm not sure what the significance of that is. The rest of chapter 5. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God." So they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they said, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." And they brought the ark to the God of Israel around. And they brought the ark of the God of Israel around. And it came about that after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion. And he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark to Ekron. And it happened as the ark of God came to Ekron that the Ekronites cried out, saying, "They have brought the ark of the God of Israel around to us, to kill us and our people." They sent, therefore, and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel, and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there, and the men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. Okay, so now, in addition to the statue falling down on two different occasions, there is something else that occurs in Ashdod, and that is that people are afflicted with tumors, and many of them die. Now, Ashdod is about, it's about 25 miles south of where the battle occurred. So they took it quite a ways to Ashdod. And that's more in the heart of where the Philistines were located. The Philistines had the five cities, and that was really the heart of Philistia. And that's on the southwest coast of Palestine. So Ashdod is more in that area, as are Gath and Ekron, the other main Philistine cities. People start dying, and people start getting these tumors. It's not clear what these tumors are. Nobody knows exactly how to translate it. Some versions translate it hemorrhoids. Other translations decided not to use that word. But we don't exactly know what the affliction is, but it is obviously unpleasant. And there are people dying as well, so it's serious as well. And it's curious that it says that the ark of God of Israel, of the God of Israel, must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God. That's interesting, because when the statue fell, Dagon's hands fell off. He's handless, while the hand of God is heavy on the people of Ashdod. Dagon is helpless. Yahweh is acting. So they decide, we got to get it out of here. They move it to another Philistine city. It goes to Gath. The same thing happens there. Tumors break out. People start dying. And they cry out and say, "We got to get rid of this." So they move it to Ekron. And at Ekron, the same thing happens. And when it arrives there, the people of Ekron, they don't want it. They want to get rid of it. They say, "They have brought the ark of the God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people." So they called the leaders of all of Philistia, and they're trying to decide what to do. And they decide, there's only one good good option. Let's send the ark back. Let's get rid of it. And apparently there were a significant number of people who died, and there were others, additional number, that were afflicted with these tumors and suffered as a result of this. Okay. What we get in, what we see in this section of Samuel is the author wants to make it clear that Israel was at a real low point at this time in its history. We've heard about the priests and their behavior, and that was wicked. And now we see the army of Israel taking the ark and taking it into battle and being defeated badly. And I think that we are to see that decision to take the ark into battle as one that was a bad decision. They should not, they ought not have done that. And as a result, the Philistines are putting a lot of pressure on them and have the Israelites in that part of Palestine in submission to them. So it's really a low point in Israel's history. But there are some bright spots. The first bright spot we saw in the very first chapter, and that is Hannah. And we saw that Hannah was a woman of faith. So in the midst of this faithlessness in Israel, there is at least one example of a woman of great faith who prays to God, is given, she was oppressed by and taunted by the other wife of her husband because she had no children. And she prayed to God that he give her a child and that she would give that child over to God's service. God granted her that child, that was Samuel, and she did indeed give that child over to God's service in the temple. So she is one bright spot. There is some faith in Israel. Then Samuel is raised up, and Samuel is a bright spot. He also seems to be, he grows in maturity, and he grows before the Lord. He seems to be a man of faith as well, like his mother. The other bright spot, then, is the ark itself. That the Israelites took the ark into the battle and lost possession of it. They couldn't defend it. But that ark was taken by the Philistines, and God was able to defend the ark. God goes to work on behalf of that which is his and defends it and inflicts losses on the Philistines so that they will return the ark. Samuel's then going to build on that spark of hope that exists in Israel, these little bright spots in what is otherwise a dark situation for Israel. Okay, now I want to talk about this situation with the ark, and this is where I will enlist your help. I think this is a very interesting event, and I'm going to make some comments, and then maybe you can help build on my comments and help sort this out. Why did they take, what happened when they took the ark into battle? The ark was the holiest object in Israel. And it was associated with some miraculous events. Just to name a couple, when they crossed the Jordan, God had told Joshua to have the priest carry the ark into the river. And as soon as they did so, the waters of the Jordan stopped, dried up, and the people of Israel walked across. So the ark was involved in that event. Then if you'll recall, in the fall of Jericho, God ordered them to carry the seventh day. They were supposed to carry the ark around Jericho. And it was on that day then that they blew the trumpets and the walls came down. So there are just two instances, and there are others, but two instances in which the ark is prominently present at a time of a miraculous event. or a very significant event. Here's a situation in which the Israelites have just been defeated by the Philistines, and they're looking at why did this happen, and there's no indication that they talk about strategy. It's not like, well, we should have been up on that hill instead of been down in this valley. It's not strategy, it's not leadership, it's not too much cowardice, it's not those, none of those kinds of considerations. The only thing that is indicated in the text is God did it. And their conclusion is that God is not with us. That's why we lost. God is not with us. And that was correct, I think. There's a sense in which that was correct. So they're thinking, well, how do we get God with us? Well, we go get his seat and we bring it with us. That seems to be the logic of it. That God is present in this thing. God is, this ark is special to God. It's his seat. We will bring it with us and thereby bring divine power. There's a sense in which it seems to me that that is a demonstration of faith. There's faith there that God, that the ark truly is the seat of God, and that they can trust in God to help them. If he were just there with them, and they demonstrated their trust in his ability to save them, to defeat the Philistines, that it will happen. So it seems to me that there is an element of faith that's there, but it's not the right kind of faith. They are using faith as a means to a temporal end. What they want is to defeat the Philistines. And they think that by trusting God, God will come through and defeat the Philistines for them. In other words, it's ultimately an act of manipulation. They're trying to get God to act for them in a certain way. If that's the case, if I'm understanding the logic of what they're doing correctly, then they're seeing themselves as being in the driver's seat, and if they just bring the ark along with them, God will be obligated to act on their behalf. Faith properly, I think, is not a means to an end, but it's an end in itself. That faith is valuing and appreciating who God is. And if I have faith, then I want to do what God wants me to do. In everything, I seek to be the servant and allow him to be the master. I never climb into the driver's seat if I see faith as an end rather than a means to an end. So if faith is an end in itself, if it's good in and of itself, then my job is to be a student of God such that I can, as well as possible, and that's what wisdom is, anticipate what God would have me do in any particular situation. But it seems to me that the temptation to use religious practices in a way to get God to do what we want is huge. I know I've done it. Do it. I mean, it's just, there's so many times that we really want what we want. We're desperate to have our own will. And how are we going to bring that about? And we know that God is powerful, so the question is, how do we get him to do what I want him to do? Let me just talk about prayer as an example, because that's certainly in my experience, that's the way where I am most tempted to do this. Prayer is, if you think about it, prayer is a phenomenal gift from God. To think that we as insignificant human beings have the opportunity to address God personally with our personal concerns, that's phenomenal. That's incredible. I mean, why would he have time? Why would he care? But he does. God is not, God is powerful, but he's not like gravity. He's not an impersonal force. He's a personal force. A God who loves us, who cares about us. So he gives us this privilege of being able to turn to him with our personal concerns. That's phenomenal. And we come to him making requests, and that's good and proper. I mean, there are other things that we do in prayer, but coming with requests is good and proper as well. But they are requests. We have to give him room to do what he's going to do. All we're doing is making our wishes known and then letting him do what he's going to do. It is just a request. The spirit of every request ought to be the spirit that was evidenced by Jesus in the garden when he said, "Not my will, but thine be done." But there's a huge temptation to shift that from a request to a demand, thinking, "I did my part, I prayed, now you are obligated, God, to come through." That's a really easy slide. One of the things that I always tried to be conscious of in my children as we were raising them is that distinction between when they were making a request and when they were making a demand. And when I sensed that it was a demand, always trying to identify that as such. And they can be very subtle, but nevertheless demands rather than requests. So it's a really easy slide from request into demand. It's one that we all do, but it's wicked. And I think that's essentially what happened with the people of Israel when they took the ark. That they were using faith to get leverage on God. That they were trying to obligate God to come to their rescue. And it seems to me that the same could be said of any religious practice. Any religious practice can be transformed from what it is rightly into some kind of demand on God or leverage on God. And that's wrong. It all comes down to the question of who's master. Okay, now I would welcome comments, questions with respect to this.
In 4 verse 9, It says, "Lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they've been slaves to you." When were they slaves to the Hebrews?
Say that once again.
"As they have been slaves to you, Therefore be men and fight." When were the Philistines slaves to the Hebrews?
I think...
Pardon me?
Lest you take...
The other way around, right? The other way around.
The Philistines have gained dominance in that area. So you see that in Judges in general, in the book before this one, in Judges, or two books before this. The pattern is that one of the neighbors of Israel will become strong, and they will come to dominate some portion of Palestine and bring the Israelites that live in that area under subjection to them. And one way or another, have to pay taxes and tribute or whatever to them. And apparently that has happened in this portion of Israel, that in that area around Aphek, that's north of where Philistia proper is. Apparently they expanded into that area and have dominated the Israelites there.
Second question would be, do you think that the Philistines came to understand that the Hebrew God would allow the Philistines or use the Philistines to discipline them but not to destroy them? You think they got the idea that, yeah, we beat them in this battle and we took their ark. Mm-hmm. But bottom line is they destroy our God. They destroy our men. It's just like we can't fight him, but we can fight them, kind of a understanding.
Mm-hmm. My suspicion in this kind of situation is that for the most part, no, they didn't come to understand that. But God works in the heart of each individual a little differently. It wouldn't surprise me if there were some, a few, who came to that understanding and recognized that Yahweh is indeed the God, and that He was behind this, and that what happened was all a part of the way that God was dealing with His people of Israel, and understood exactly what you were saying. I suspect there would be a few.
Two questions. Why do you suppose the Philistines, when they're so protective of Dagon, they see clear evidence that Yahweh is more powerful than Dagon, except so instead of switching allegiance and saying, obviously Dagon is not worth having as a god, mm-hmm. they try to protect him from Yahweh. Why didn't they just say, hey, let's go with the guy who's yeah. who's the more powerful?
Yeah, I don't know. I would suspect part of it is just a kind of cultural conservatism and loyalty to this God that has, I mean, prior to this time, if they are to assess their history, their God has been good to them. They've come a long way. They're a much more powerful nation group than they had been 200, 300 years prior. So it could be that their thinking is, we just need, he is a good God. He's pretty powerful. He's a high-ranking God. So for that reason, we should hang in there. But maybe we haven't served him as well as we should, or maybe a few sacrifices were overdone or something. I'm just guessing, but...
The second question is, when I was a fairly new believer, somebody gave me a book called The Jesus Person Pocket Promise Book, which even in my relative level of ignorance, I was appalled at. Basically, the thesis of this book was that God has made promises, and the way we demonstrate our faith is by claiming them, mm-hmm. and that... essentially, they had prayers in there that basically said, God, you promised this, and you can't go back on your word, so you better cough up here. And they called that faith. And I was wondering if you'd run into that, the idea of claiming promises, mm-hmm. and could make some comment on that.
Well, that's exactly the kind of thing I have in mind here as being truly wicked. But it's not... It's an attempt to manipulate God. I mean, it's getting leverage on God so that you can get Him to do what you want Him to do. And that's contrary to what faith is all about completely. It turns it on its head. All in the name of faith.
The first time I kind of looked through this and read on this, when they brought the ark out into battle... And Eli's son being evil and so many of the other things happening. I kind of disagree with you a little bit that it was an act of faith. To me, it kind of reminded me of people and good luck charms and, relics and so on, that instead of us having faith, it's like we're going to rely on this. And because... this item is going to give us what we want instead of really a relationship and trying to build faith. And the second thing, I think what was why God may have taken the head and the hands off Dagon is one, for two reasons. One, because I think even in that time, beheading was kind of a punishment reserved for royalty and certain other things. And then also it represents removing of the head of the knowledge and wisdom and so on. And then hands like to do and represent basically emasculating, taking away the strength of Dagon.
Yeah, I don't know about the symbolism of the head, But the hands, I think that's right. It makes a, the symbolism there is he can't do anything, as opposed to God who can. Now, what I mean by faith in the first part, the faith that they have is that God is powerful and that he can defeat the Philistines. And the, so there is a kind of faith there. It's just not the kind of faith that is required of us.
I'm responding to your invitation. Everything you said, I think, was great. I agree with it all, and I think that's a very important thing to take from it. It strikes me that there's an element that goes with this story that's kind of implied as well, which is what they did not do in the situation. Because they have something that we don't have in their relationship with God. They have specific covenant promises related to the land and their obedience and so on. So they have the right to expect, not to demand, but to expect that if they're being faithful, God will in fact allow them to prevail in battle and they will be safe in the land and so on. So the fact that God let them lose, the question that they ought to be confronting is, why is he displeased with us? What is it? And the fact that their high priests are corrupt and the land is pretty faithless and all of that, the opportunity is for them to reflect on themselves as a nation and repent, you know, call and say, you know, what did we do, God? Tell us where we're going wrong. But instead, they take the route that you say, well, God's associated with that. Let's get that and make him do it. Just the reason I bring that up is it seems to me that that's an important thing. We see that same thing in the Pharisees, and it's an important thing to understand that religion can do, that you can take something that looks like, hey, I believe in this God. I'm counting on him to do something, but that's actually a way of hiding from what I really ought to be confronting. That's what the Pharisees did with the law. It looked like they were really committed to it, but they were committed to it in a way that protected them from having to analyze themselves. So,
I got a couple of points. One of them that is a little bit disturbing to me is, I've heard a number of people say this, that I'm so insignificant. How can I possibly talk to God? My feeling is every human being is insignificant to God. I think we're the center of his attention. I think it's like a parent. If you've got one kid, you get two or three, you get five or six or nine or ten. Every one of those kids is super important to you. It's just that sometimes if they're all making demands, some of them are not going to get the demands that they want. And the second thing is that ark was not to be used at their will. That everything you told them in Jericho and that there, that's when God told them to use the ark. The Palestinians, if I remember right, when Joshua gave out the land to the tribes, one of the tribes that was supposed to drive out the Palestinians, they didn't do it. They decided they were tired of battle, and they left them gone. And I think this is part of the reasons that they lost in that battle, because they didn't finish what God had asked them to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I meant by we're insignificant is there's nothing about me inherently that should make me significant in God's eyes. The fact that I'm significant is really his attitude towards me. It's a gift of him towards me. It's not something, I'm not inherently significant. I'm only significant because he chooses to see me as significant. And that's what's phenomenal. That's what's truly a gift.
I guess the only thing that comes to mind is about that ark is sometimes people will do is, when you're talking about what praying is, I see God working in my life so many times as I look back at it, my 65 years, and I'm thinking, he's acting, and I'm not even asking. I'm asking, and he's not acting.
In addition to what you've said, it seems like there's a shift that we make from, take the example of the ark. God used the ark to symbolize his power and his presence in Jericho and crossing the Jordan and so on. The problem is they didn't get it. They didn't understand, it seems to me, that they shift their focus off to the invisible, transcendent God who wills what he wills and does what he does. and onto an object and turns it into magic rather than, I think that's what was happening with the disciples a few months ago when we talked about the apostles unable to cast out the demon. And Jesus says, oh, you have little faith, that they just didn't get it. They didn't understand. They didn't understand that the power didn't reside in them and in their words and in their laying on of hands or whatever, that that's not where the power was. The power was in the sovereign, invisible God who does what he does when he wants to do it. And that was always the case with the Ark of the Covenant. It wasn't that there was power in the Ark, magical power in the Ark, but rather it was just a representative, a metaphor for the presence of God. And I think that's partly what they've lost sight of as well.
Going back to the issue of significance, I appreciate the spirit behind saying that we're not inherently significant. Certainly anything that... anything that's me is entirely dependent upon God. And when we say, to say that we were inherently significant, almost it makes me feel like I've sort of got God in an arm lock, in a way, that there's some... If I were significant, that would imply that I had the right to make demands of God. And I agree, we don't have the right to make demands of God. The trouble is that when you say that human beings are not inherently significant, then I cannot understand God's behavior to act as if we are significant or to choose that we are significant. Because if you say, well, you know, God chooses to love me, he doesn't have to love me, he chooses to love me, then I have to ask, well, why? Why does he do that? And so various explanations are offered. Well, because it suits him to do that, okay, but why does it suit him to do that? Well, he's trying to reveal who he is. Well, if he's acting as if he loves me, but he doesn't really, then that doesn't really reveal who he is. And if he really does love me, that suggests, I mean, when it comes down to it, I think the best answer is he's good, but that tends to imply that goodness would require him to act the way he does. If the reason he loves me is because he's good, goodness must require it. Why does goodness require it? The only explanation I can think of is that we are significant. Now, if I am significant, God is not just acting as if I'm significant, sort of like taking a jar of pond scum and putting it at your table and offering it some nice food or something like that. That would be stupid. But if we really are significant, it's nothing I can lay credit to. I mean, God has made me the kind of a being that it makes sense to behave the way he does. And in fact, perhaps he has obligated himself in creating me to be the kind of person he is, in the same way as when a father begets a child, he has taken upon himself an obligation. This is a significant being. It is a significant being, and the father is obligated, but he has obligated himself. Does that make sense at all?
There is a sense in which, yes, we are significant beings. God created us in his image. But what does it mean to be significant? God is much more significant than we are. So if we put ourselves in comparison to God, we are insignificant. Do we have no significance? Well, he built significance into us, and he chooses to honor that significance. And that I think, is what makes us significant. So
I think our significance is a reflection of God's significance. We are derivative. We are in his image. If he were not significant, we would certainly not be significant. Right. And we are a copy. We are a derivative. But you say he chooses to honor that significance. What would it mean if he chose not to honor that significance? It seems like then I don't understand why he does. If it's not a reflection of his goodness, why does he do it? And if it is a reflection of his goodness, does not that mean goodness would require it?
Mm-hmm. Well, could he not honor that?
and still be good?
In a sense, he could, and in a sense, he couldn't. I mean, really, my only point is God didn't, where this all came from is God didn't have to give us the privilege of being able to address him as a person, person to person. And the fact that he does is phenomenal. It's not because we're worthy of it. It's not because we deserve it somehow. But that's incredible.